to start with a quote from Salman Rushdie. There's no place like home, except of course for the home we make, or the homes that are made for us in Oz, which is anywhere and everywhere, except the place from which we began. The Wizard of Oz, Fleming, 1939, argues the novelist Salman Rushdie, is a film that speaks of two great challenges in life, migration and growing up. In a film that insists that there is no place like home, his argument is informed by the vital understanding that leaving anywhere requires a fantasy of home for departure and arrival and return. Film fantasy refers to the cinematic rendering of the impossible and the immaterial, producing the mise-en-scene of desire. In fantasy narratives, chronotopes, the narration of space and time, are often surprisingly configured. Time and space are desynchronized, twisted, folded, and reversed. Alice runs into the rabbit hole, and Max plays with the wild things across the seas, and still gets home in time for his glass of milk. In cinema, time and space and materiality are constructed through representation and affect, in order to tell a story, or to present an idea, or to relish an aesthetic possibility. In the literary theorist Zetvan Todorov's view, fantasy is differentiated from realism by presenting as marvellous, as uncanny, or as truly fantastical, but without leaving the realm of the ordinary. Fantasy is elsewhere described as magical by Jameson, sublime by Bloom, Harold Bloom, and uncertain by Lance Olson. In James Donald's work, and yes, there is a connection, he's my husband, fantasy is the way, so I had to read this before, I don't mention it to the end. Anyway, in James Donald's work, fantasy is the way in which we collaborate with cinema to present what is difficult to name, often dangerous to encounter, but impossible to escape, except perhaps through fantasy itself. Thus, it is crucial that committed and legible structures of fantasy are available across and within cultures, historical periods, and socio-religious groups and populations to make possible the communication of affect. Fantasy is not random. It formulates and expresses the anxieties of the social body, including the fear of transition and homelessness. Children, I would argue, are particularly susceptible to adult fantasies, and indeed film and literary scholars have noted that children are more often than not deployed in order to play out a fear that besets adults. Now, migration is a heavily politicized concept, which encompasses the complexities of causation, settlement, pluricultural societies and national identities, and attracts the fear of previously settled populations. Migration entails mobility, the actual movements of peoples and resources, whilst also drawing attention to the uncertainties of those settled migrants, both those that were there and those that are coming. The uncertainties of arrival and settlement result in an internalized mobility. That is, quite literally, feeling neither here, nor there, or needing to be in two places at once. Alternatively, the continuing process of settlement may be achieved through a grounded or ordinary cosmopolitanism, a maturity of vision and expectation, whereby the hopes of settlement are tempered and achieved through a localized cosmopolitan vision. These ordinary cosmopolitans come and go when they can, maintain multiple and complex family relationships, and settle for a layered and multidimensional version of homeliness. Arguably, this necessary process of adaptation and renewal is exactly what terrifies those who see themselves as settled. As I will show later in a brief reference to Australian cinema, the mobility of the Indigenous subject is conversely threatening to migrant settlers who refuse to acknowledge their own continuing transitions. So today I want to explore what I'm calling the Dorothy complex, by which I mean the various configurations of the character, relationships and narrative that make up the structure of fantasy that is Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, and that haunts or informs other films that treat of the journey from child to adult and of the journeys of migration seen through the eyes of a child or simply represented as a child's misadventure. I examine how the Dorothy complex recurs in different cultural contexts, today specifically China, Ireland, France and Australia, and suggest that the transcultural recurrence of narrative patterns is nonetheless grounded in the specificities of culture and time. These are migration narratives that re-articulate the chronotopes of nationality and belonging to account for both arrival and return, and for multiple transcultural encounters along the way. As such, the Dorothy complex provides a framework of resonance for cinematic fantasies of transition, chief of which are migration and growing up. My examples relate to contemporary issues in the politics of migration, post-colonial staying on, urbanization, grounded cosmopolitanism, and the post-diasporic condition. Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz is probably the most famous child character in world cinema, and our little survey just now proves that. The extraordinary performance, both mature and self-effacing, and the sweetness of the singing voice of Judy Garland, which we have to imagine, have a lot to do with Dorothy's longevity. But there is more at stake in this protagonist. Dorothy and her adventure represent a certain version of America, youth, movement, opportunity, self-made heroism. And by the way, self-made heroism is a term that Margaret Mead came up with to describe the American child when she was working on different versions of childhood around Europe and the Americas. The Dorothy complex is not, however, restricted to the American context and may, I think, be understood as a kind of transcultural archetype. But then I might actually just do a little segue on that, because an archetype, as I'm sure you all know, generally assumes a preformed narrative trajectory pursued by a protagonist in a formal relationship with the verbal and written traditions of the culture in question. So the story would have a synchronic coherence and depth of reference for readers and audience, whilst retaining a diachronic freshness to the specific tale or plotline. But the archetype can also, and this is particularly the case in Chinese literature, refer not so much to the forward motion and cyclical nature of pre-loved narratives and people or personages, as to a shared understanding of relationships, abstractions, and non-narrative qualities of personal place. An archetype that could be argued to breach both definitions sometimes is the Oedipus myth, which has some resonance with the Confucian horror of inappropriate relationships, as well as in a European sense of impossible desire driving us to fates that simultaneously repel and attract us. But really, if you look at Chinese narrative fiction, it's more about relationships between modes, so between stillness and mobility, for instance, would be a literary mode, and that's where the archetype might reside. Anyway, back to Dorothy. Dorothy is a country girl. She's from impoverished Kansas, and she copes magnificently with the challenges of the foreign, the strange, the dangerous, and the city. Yet despite her triumphs, she chooses to go home, and indeed everything she has done in Oz has been in order to go home. Oz is anywhere and everywhere, but not the place where we began. Dorothy's return to Kansas is, however, a return migration to a place she never entirely left, but also to a place that will now be always familiar and always disappointing. Oz is a fantastic representation of home, more colourful, but with the same cast of characters, although extended and made more dangerous, more exotic, and more malleable. Oz is more delightful than the place of origin, for Oz is a place where Dorothy, teenager, child, migrant, can take control, solve her problems and those of others, and even leave with the click of her heels, if she so chooses. Through her encounter with Oz, it's tempting to see Dorothy as an archetype both of the migrant and of the child in transition to adulthood. However, and this is where transcultural articulations of the Dorothy complex are interesting in their variations, points of such extreme transition in human experience as migration and growing up might conceivably shift the very premises of fantasy as the immaterial counterpoint to how life is understood and lived in a particular place at a specific time. Such a shift might then undermine the reliability of the archetype. So that's the problem with the notion of the archetype. The maturing child and the migrant combine in Dorothy. This double transitional status poses a double threat to normative stability that must therefore be recuperated in the plot. So despite the brightness of her new environment, she prefers home to Oz and goes back to Kansas. She's told she has been nowhere, that she must have been dreaming. She contests this, but soon agrees to disagree and confirms that she will never leave home and her loved ones again. The return of the uncanny at the end of the film could be a retreat from fantasy, or, and I would prefer this reading, be credited as further cause for the transnational afterlife of the story. After migration, there is in fact, quite truly, quite literally, no place like home. The desire for home has replaced the certainty of belonging. Being at home becomes an uncanny or unheimlich experience. As we will see in other uses, and I'm referring to Göktürk's work there. As we will see in other uses of the Dorothy complex, sometimes the transnational migration of the narrative pattern quite explicitly brings this threat of dislocation and contradiction to the surface of the text. The premise of the original Dorothy in the Dorothy complex in The Wizard of Oz are A, that everyone must have a place to call home, B, home is a place which is desired and to which it is nonetheless possible to return, C, the yellow brick road that leads from one place to another is clearly marked, D, friends will be easily recognisable on the road, E, the real dangers lurk beyond the road or in the forests, and F, the city is not all it's cut out to be, once you get there. Nor should we forget that Dorothy is an orphan, even, or perhaps especially, an orphan must understand about home. This set of circumstances, many of which are contradictory, may tell us something about how representations of children are used by society to articulate and swiftly displace the confusion and contradictions and sheer terror of being adult. Simultaneously, the otherness and challenges of the incoming migrant are reduced in the imagination of the receiving culture to the dream work of a child. At the same time, and this is what I want to understand about the figure of Dorothy, the complex repeats across quite, apparently quite dissimilar socio-political and socio-cultural moments and places. What links the Dorothys that I see in films from China, Ireland, France, Australia, are they symptoms of a shared structure of alienation through which adults the world over manage and deploy the unruly idea of childhood? Are they direct borrowings from a particularly powerful cinematic origin, the 1939 film? There is, of course, a 1914 film and a 1910 film of The Wizard of Oz as well, which Frank Baum made. And you can get them on YouTube and they're worth looking at. They are hilarious. But it's the 39 film where this really comes together. Or are they indirect borrowings whereby a successful narrative articulation of affect establishes an aesthetic convention that then migrates into different cultural and historical contexts? In the latter scenario, the borrowings are contingent as well as spontaneous and provide similar but socio-culturally distinct answers to the question of how to deal with those who are ontologically distinct from the normative centre of settled existence. My contention is that the child and the migrant bear between them the burden of widespread and enduring anxieties about mobility and transformation. This is evident in the contradictions that others have seen in migrant cinema, and that are also evident in films about children. The child is the point of entry to fantasy, but the child is an unreliable witness. A child's perspective is simultaneously suspect and privileged in film. To the adult world, she is both necessary and dangerous, often uncanny, because she is ontologically not an adult, and therefore may not obey the rules that contain fantasy and that contain fantasy and behaviours associated with archetypal expectations in the social structure constructed and inhabited by adults. Childhood is different. Ontologically, it defines a time-space wherein the hierarchies that organise adult society and culture are not entirely absent, but nor are they always preeminent or accessible. Bringing the migrant and the child into an archetype allows cinema to indulge an excess of otherness and relegates both migrant and child to the margins of the real. For example, a post-colonial child may be both a child in the presence of adults and a vehicle of unequal power or disadvantage in the face of different adults and other children at one and the same time. And Dina Yordanova has made that point. The associated pathology, and I'm discussing this now in relation to Claire Denis's White Material, still from it there, from 2010, is that if an adult retains a fantasy of colonial belonging, this may become inextricably confused with the flattened ontology of childhood and adult myths of childish invulnerability and exceptionalism. So in White Material, Isabelle Huppert plays Maria, a French coffee farmer in an unnamed post-colonial African state, which we think is probably Cameroon. She's a lonely figure, living in a household with her ex-husband and his child with a local woman, and her own teenage son. The political status quo is disintegrating, and rebels are recruiting child soldiers to fight the incumbent government, which in turn sends out hunting parties to kill the children. Maria refuses to leave the farm, despite the urging of French soldiers, who fly overhead in a helicopter imploring her to leave. Instead, she pretends that she's in control right up until the destruction of her family, the death of her son, and her own madness. Maria will simply not accept that she is not African enough to survive or to be anything other than white material, a rag of human history worth less than nothing in the current state of affairs. The flimsiness of White Material and of Maria's grasp on reality is emphasised by her choice of girl-like cotton dresses. One such dress is stolen and worn by a teenage girl soldier. If nothing else would convince us that this Maria Dorothy misunderstands her age, her status, and the danger in which she places herself and others, the dress as transitional object quite literally brings fantasy and materiality too close for comfort. In several sequences related to the extended flashback that organises the film's duration, she's on a yellow dust road leading between the town and the property. This place, between places, is a road home, but also a road that is referred to by locals as dangerous. Standing alone on the road, she shouts and flails her arms at the helicopters above her, that's the French helicopter, which is trying to help her, runs into the scrub lines land to hide from passing army trucks, and leaves the tracks to pursue the origins of blood-soaked clothes into the bush. In each case, she misreads the sources of danger, even as she retains a childish sense of inviolability in her particular Oz. But as we see in the flashbacks, to which she's not privy, real child soldiers are murdered in their poppy-induced sleep, and her own teenage son, who has joined the soldiers on the yellow dust road and shared with them the drugs they have looted from the village pharmacy, burns to death when he takes them home. Meanwhile, the gate to the property is locked and unlocked, the exercise of locking up becoming ever more futile as the film progresses, and the boundary between the Emerald City of colonial privilege and the harshness of the lands around disappears. Many sequences have visual echoes in Dorothy's trials on the way to Oz. They're not exact. Poisonous poppies and drugs are equally pernicious. But the French helicopter that Maria bats away, even though it's there to save her, reminds one of the witch and flying monkeys that attack Dorothy and her companions. It's a symptom of the multiple errors that Maria makes in relation to her own role in the narrative, in her own narrative. She too thinks that there is no place like home, and in so doing, she doesn't see that she is neither dreaming nor awake. This fantasy is neither marvellous nor uncanny, it is in fact lethal. Rather than heroically finding her way and saving her farm as she believes she is, she walks down a path to utter loss and abandonment. We remember that Dorothy inadvertently kills a witch as soon as she arrives in Munchkinland, and this feat renders her a witch. As Maria travels up and down the dust road on more and more fruitless and foolish forays, all of which end in the death of others, she is herself turning into one of the nastier local witches. I start with White Material because Maria is both a highly suggestive perversion of the framework of reference offered by them by the Dorothy complex. Maria's transformation from Dorothy girl woman on the yellow road to a murderous Dorothy witch in the ashes of the place called home exemplifies the dynamics and fluidity of the representation of child and outsider, and is quite explicit that this protagonist will not be recuperated and will not go home. The complex as archetype is particularly tempting here, although I still, I think, resist archetype, given Maria's insanity and the criticisms made of Jung, to wit that his archetypes were interpretative categories through which he could externalise and disguise his own madness. The Wizard of Oz is itself not free of colonial inference. Frank Baum's original book was published successfully in 1900 and the film released nearly 40 years later in 1939. Debates about the story's politics, social commentary, and allegorical function continue to the present, and include charges that Dorothy is a colonial adventurer, recalibrating time and space to fit the requirements of her quest. John Funchen has recently contributed a quite superb essay that positions Dorothy as an American adventurer at the vanguard of 20th century imperialism, whereby the rest of the world, he's written it with hindsight though, it has to be said, rest of the world serves as a playground of high cosmopolitan policy, a fantasy world order that claims and reinforces the centrality of the United States. Funchen is austere and exact in his judgment on why the American child is allowed to wander on the yellow brick road. And I quote, "Bound does not so much reconcile nostalgia with cosmopolitanism as depict Dorothy's nostalgia for Kansas as the desire that compels her to develop a cosmopolitan ethos only as a means to return home." Funchen's point is one of analogy with US foreign policy abroad and conservatism at home. Dorothy, for him, is not an innocent abroad, but an American abroad, in a period of growing United States confidence. Funchen's not clear whether he refers both to Bound's Dorothy of the 1900s and the more famous Dorothy of 1939, and that is a bit of a hole in his argument, nonetheless. Funchen's Dorothy, nevertheless, gains prestige and power the further she is from Kansas, and she deploys cosmopolitanism as a mode of parochial authority with strangers. As the Good Witch of the North, Glinda, tells her before she goes home, "You always had the power to return." And that, of course, is not true of most migrants. The next section I'll call The Missing Child. In children's film stories, Emma Wilson has referred to the missing child in cinema and called, several years ago now, for a new cinematic politics of childhood. I suggest that the cinematic figure of Dorothy is one such articulation. She broaches different scales and types of childhood and child mobility, forced migration, fantasies of escape, quests, running away from home, and also the adults who hide in the Dorothy complex to avoid the emplaced actualities of being either child or adult. I'm not suggesting that these are wholly similar or commensurate experiences, but am rather seeking a rhetorical principle or framework of resonance, a structure of attention, for seeing the cinematic child through one particular but recurrent symptomatic trope, the intrepid, intrusive orphan on the yellow brick road, dancing and darting between home and arrival. In 2002, the director Ning Ying shot Railroad of Hope, which was a documentary vox pop treatment of internal Chinese migration from Sichuan to Xinjiang. Most travellers in the film are peasants, or farmers rather, farmer peasants, and many are first-time economic migrants, for whom this three-day journey across Western China is their first time on a train. They expect to spend a short time cotton picking in Xinjiang and return home with enough extra cash to pay for their children's school fees, lay something aside for their old age, or just have a little fun. The film was shot at the end of a decade, the 1990s, of accelerated Han population expansion, and as, again, most of you will know that Han is the dominant ethnicity in the PRC, in the People's Republic, into Xinjiang, which is a predominantly minority region, with Muslim Uyghurs the largest ethnic grouping, and who have a long history of resistance to occupation. This internal migration is part of a larger expansionist policy, the Open Up the West policy. In the 1990s, the policy prompted subventions for the cotton industry, which in turn fueled a need for outside labour and population inflow. The population ratio in Xinjiang at the end of the last century, the year 2000, had jumped from 10% Han ethnicity to nearly 50%. The film is made up of short interviews, both in the queue at the railway station and on the train. The filmmakers sought prior approval, of course, from the Chinese Railway Authority, and this is apparent. Pre-approved interview questions, a rather benign view of the harried police and railway workers, and a film which ends as the train crosses the Gobi Desert into Xinjiang proper, right on the brink of a terrain which is not usually available for filmmakers. There is certainly no overt discussion of the relationships between Xinjiang locals and incoming migrant workers, let alone any comment on the political tensions that they may encounter on arrival. This is to a large degree because the film is entirely comprised of interviews with people who have never been out of their home villages and counties before and would be most likely to have any patience for or understanding of anti-Han feeling. And of course, not all the migrants would necessarily be Han, as Sichuan has long been the crossing point of cosmopolitan exchange and diversion in the various territories subsumed into the PRC. And if you want to think more about cosmopolitanism's China as a cosmopolitan space, then there is work on that too, and it's a good kind of shift in thinking, I think. The interviews are short and suggestive, and offer tantalising glimpses into the state of happiness or misery for contemporary China contemporary Chinese farmer peasants. But my interest today is an unnamed girl standing in the queue at the start of the film. She appears to be travelling alone, whereas many others are in larger groups or from various villages. You know, obviously you would travel together if you could. The interview reveals that she's 14 years old and she's not making the journey to pick cotton, but to attend school. Her near family, mother, father and brother, are all in Xinjiang already, and she hasn't seen them for 4 years. And she has to be there, she says, by the 28th of January. And she's very upset about this. I'm not going to try and show a clip because it won't work. She comes from the county of Pingcheng. So as she imparts these small but cumulative slips of information, she begins to cry, as though the expression of her duty, her loneliness, and the stress of transition has suddenly become overwhelming. The emotional pressure is emphasized by an unrelenting extreme close-up, such that the intensity of the camera's focus on her own image seems complicit in reducing her to tears. For several moments, screen space is reduced to the bewildered face of a single child, and in those moments on screen, the uncertainties of migration, settlement and occupation are rhetorically assumed through the camera's unduly close attention. This Dorothy is not an orphan, but she has been living as though she were, we presume with older relatives, as is often the case for those who have come to be known as left behind children. Her experience is replicated all over Sichuan and indeed all over China, as families fragment in search of work and in face of the complexities of the internal residency permits. The situation is so acute that the Red Cross is using trauma recovery strategies developed after the 2007 Sichuan earthquake to help left behind children express themselves. Meanwhile, as the Xinjiang riots of 2009 to 2011 and continuing confirm, this Dorothy's presence in Xinjiang will be experienced by young Uyghurs as an imperialist incursion and a direct threat to the remnants of their cultural autonomy. So this encounter, if you like, is already overdetermined for both parties, both children. Now, I'm not suggesting that Ningying explicitly recalls Garland's Dorothy in her film, but I do observe that she introduces an abstracted and relational version of the child migrant in one sequence, and that this young girl bears a certain representational significance to the Dorothy complex. She's a child migrant who is an outsider, who has no control over the decision to move between home and family. She is nonetheless central to the politics of mobility that makes her migration necessary in the first place. The child in Railroad cries because she's frightened and because we're looking at her. If we take up Wilson's idea of the missing child, we have to ask, what if the body is both visible and missing, or seen only as a crowd, or as a thing to be controlled or saved, the rampaging child and the vulnerable child? The cinematic child is then riveted to its own non-being, its own always becoming. The child in Ningying's film is visible in close-up for a few moments of close questioning, but then she disappears into the throng. Her narrative is both rhetorically framed and deliberately truncated. This may be unethical, or a dismissal of childhood subjectivity, or it could be understood as a comment on the missing subjectivity of child migrants themselves. Ningying perhaps does not want to fool us into thinking that this is a story that can be resolved through narrative continuity and the clicking of red heels. The child migrants in China are numerous. It's estimated that there are 20 million left behind children, many of whom will themselves migrate. Caught between family and place of origin, the homelessness of these children is profound. There is no easy solution either to their drive to migrate or to the emotional deprivation of having been left behind. Now, my third film is Kisses, by 2008, Lance Daly. Now, Kisses, or Lance Daly, is aware of the problem of missing children in cinema, and he seeks to foreground it through direct and indirect reference to Dorothy. The attention to the child protagonist is careful, and they are, if you like, trusted to witness their own story. If the subject matter were not so challenging, it would be a children's film. As it is a children's film for adults. In brief, it quotes The Wizard of Oz extensively and explicitly. The film splits the key protagonist into two children, a boy and a girl, and introduces companions on the metaphorical yellow brick road, who are actual migrants within the context of the story, which is Ireland pre the crash of 2007. The narration shifts between fantasy and realism, and in the early sequence with the violent father also quotes Kubrick's The Shining, which of course is another powerful fantasy narrative structure about an adult's misrecognition of himself, his decline into madness materialising as a murderous attack on his own home. The Kisses concerns two children, Dylan and Kylie, who escape violent family situations in the suburbs of Dublin and run away to the city to look for Dylan's elder brother. Their adventure is told as a semi-magical quest which turns both sour and sweet as the night draws in, and the city becomes increasingly hostile. The film uses monochrome in the opening sequence at the children's homes and moves into colour as they travel to Dublin. Song, the songs of Bob Dylan to be specific, so you're going to miss those, but some of you might be pleased for that, are the soundtrack to the adventure into Oz, and colours are provided by the city's bright lights, Dublin as the Emerald City on the Emerald Isle. The children use money stolen from Kylie's sibling to buy new clothes and flashing trainers with inbuilt Skeeler wheels. These, of course, are the ruby slippers. This purchase becomes pertinent later on as Dylan saves Kylie from an attack. And the film is indeed full of glimpses of magic, making us privy to the experience of the city as it unfolds from the perspective of these two children. These are all outsiders who help the children in one way or the other. The first is a migrant bargeman who breaks into song when he hears Dylan's name. The second is a street entertainer who impersonates Bob Dylan for a living. The kisses of the film's title occasion animated tinkling sparkles, think Glinda, when they occur. A migrant sex worker gives Dylan a magic kiss, and the children kiss each other. Across the passage of the night, the quest fails. The Wizard of Oz, Dublin, is again a failure, in that they do not find Dylan's brother. But like Dorothy, they do discover an internal mutual self-recognition. When Dylan saves Kylie from sexual predators of Dublin at night, he shows her the possibility of being saved from the predation she suffers from men at home, and proves to himself the chance of reframing a life in the future that is gentle rather than violent. The film concludes that the quest is for a life that can be lived, whether in a miserable residential suburb or in the city itself. It is a grounded cosmopolitanism. Home is where we are, and travel is how we get there. As they return to their dystopian family lives, they are at least now cognizant of their own subjective worth and significance. This temporary migration does not release the migrant from the bonds of family, but rather accentuates the relationship through distance, regret, and manifests in homecomings that are both desired and impossibly unsatisfactory. The twister carries Dorothy from Kansas to Oz, and she with her ruby slippers takes herself back again. Baz Luhrmann's high camp, textually promiscuous epic Australia 2008 also reminds us that his worldly Oz is a place of transition, a regional war zone, and a cultural metaphor for the ongoing appropriation of land and livelihood. The adults are as wild and wicked as the Wicked Witch, or as inadequate as the Wizard. The child at the centre of the film, Nulla, is also is the focus of their fantasies of control and emotional connection to each other and to the land itself. And of course, where the film falls down, it also becomes the fantasy of the film, and that is the problem. It is thus imperative that Nulla escapes them and the forced migration from his homelands, which echoes the multiple forced migrations of the stolen generations of fair-skinned indigenous children. He finally achieves homecoming by leaving home, the property run by the English migrant owner Nicole Kidman. And the textual reference to Kidman's early role in a film about Sydney, Emerald City, is not irrelevant here, and embarks on an actual homegoing, walkabout, with the magical elder King George. And you see King George and Nulla in this still. Again, there is an intertextual reference to the actor David Gulpilil, who plays King George and who played the young Aboriginal man in Walkabout, Nick Rogue's film from 1971. Thus, Luhrmann indulges his cinematic nostalgia, giving not just Australia, but also Walkabout a retrospective happy ending, returning Oz to itself through the walkabout of the otherwise dispossessed dispossessed Aboriginal child. The nostalgic affect is comparable to that in Claire Denis' Chocolat from 1988, whereby the children engender a might-have-been cosmopolitanism through a nostalgic, and I'm quoting Adam Muller here, encounter between children and adults, resulting in more understanding, more kindness, an increase in moral goodness. So in conclusion, I've suggested that the Dorothy complex provides a framework of resonance in transnational film, which in turn supports a structure of attention through which the cinematic child may be seen and may be seen to be always in some kind of transition. The complex resonates most powerfully in stories of migration, with the emphasis as much on return as arrival, whereby the dreamlike assertion, there is no place like home, or there's no place like home, takes a second meaning. There is nowhere that is truly home anymore. In this process of recurrence, the Dorothys are symptomatic of a post-diasporic and uncanny recasting of the anxieties of migration which are fantasized within the marginalization of childhood and child migrants in particular. The notion of archetype is a possible way of capturing these observations, but noting that this is not an archetype stemming from the wandering Odysseus or the playing child in Chinese scrolls and literature. The child as archetype is a modern phenomenon that we can only see because of the work of Freud and Winnicott, who have in their different ways educated us to take note of the child in ourselves, a strange demon that pursues the present, mainly because she was so little regarded in her own childhood present. In the Chinese archetypal structure, it is, however, the relation between principles rather than the behaviour and motivation of protagonists that is most important. And I'll leave you with the relational principles that Andrew Klax finds in The Dream of the Red Chamber. Movement and stillness, elegant and baseness, joy and sorrow, union and separation, harmony and conflict, prosperity and decline.